It is my great pleasure to have the job of trying to bring to life the voices of the participants of the Russian Revolution. And that means focusing in on the speeches and the debates and the resolutions at a factory level, because it's here in the factories in Petrograd that we find ourselves among the engine room of the revolution. And yet, of the volumes that has been written about the Russian Revolution, workers' own participation in it is reduced to little more than a footnote. And that goes for the Western historians and it goes for the Soviet historians as well. See, for the Western historians, you get the view that the workers, where they do appear, are an angry mob, they're this anarchic mass, and their passions can be easily inflamed by manipulative leaders like Lenin. You see, the other side of the coin, the Soviet historians, even though rhetorically are all about the working class, of course, for them, the workers are reduced to a passive, obedient, disciplined, and increasingly correct mass of people. And so I think I'd argue that this is equally as passive as the way that the Western historians view them. And so what I want to do is try to explore the factory committee movement. And what I'm going to argue is that the spread of the factory committees and the extension of their activities was driven by the nature of the economic crisis itself. And it was a practical response to the problems that people faced. I'm also going to argue that these economic struggles led quite directly to the question of political power. And I want to look at how both the moderates, and here I'm talking about the SRs and the Mensheviks, how they fared as against the strategy of the Bolsheviks, and how useful were the strategies that they argued for to the workers as they conducted their struggles in the factories. So I want to start with February, because after days of clogging the streets, the working class successfully bring down the Tsar. And the mood at this time is one of absolute euphoria. And I want to read you two accounts from two participants. And, you know, I don't apologise for the fact that I've tried very deliberately to use the voices of the people who participated. And so, you know, you're going to be subjected to a number of quotes, but I think, not too many, because then I realise we'd be here for 3 hours. So within limits. But, so, we have a Bolshevik worker at the Nobel Machine Construction Factory wrote to his family, and he said, "I congratulate you on the joyous holiday of Russian liberation, my dear ones. In these general days of amnesty, please amnesty me for my criminal silence. Caught up in the revolutionary movement, I thought of nothing and no one, forgot everything and everyone. On February 22nd, on my way to work, I found myself in a demonstration of 20,000 persons, and I wasn't able to regain my senses till the last few days. I was everywhere, of course, at the first demonstrations and during the shooting and when the troops rose. Then together with the soldiers in the arsenals of Peter and Paul, we stole revolvers and rifles and rode in a car to arrest police, as you do. Was at meetings, assemblies, I even spoke myself. In such days, one cannot stand aside, and only in the last few days have I sobered up. Having fallen into the whirlpool of events, you become a chip of wood, carried along and spun around." So it gives you a sense of the turmoil and the exhilaration. A woman at a rubber factory recalled her sense of coming of age. She said, "I can't express my joy. I considered myself lost forever at the bosses, and suddenly I was resurrected. I grew up. That night I put on Russian boots and my husband's cap, a worker's overcoat, and said farewell to my children, and I didn't come home for 4 days." Okay, so although the historical debate focuses on whether the October Revolution was premature, whether taking power in October was too soon, I think the real question for serious students of the Russian Revolution is, well, why not then and there, having achieved the momentous task of bringing down the Tsar, do the workers not take power? We're talking about an extremely politically advanced working class among the metal workers, particularly in Petrograd, a working class that is embittered by the First World War. Well, why not then? Because what happens is that the newly formed workers' organizations, the Soviets, the moderates who dominate them from the outset, or at the, you know, yeah, at this time, they cede power to the provisional government, which is the bourgeois democratic parliament. Now, for the moderates, as I, you know, the Mensheviks and the SRs, for them, it's because of their theoretical conception of the revolution. They see it as a bourgeois democratic revolution, and that the role that social democrats should play is to maximise the gains and democracy for the working class, but within the limited framework of capitalism. And the operative word here is limited. The Menshevik Tsessatali, who became a minister, the Minister of War in Kerensky's provisional government, explained his approach, or the Mensheviks' approach. They said, the workers are a large part of the population, but they're not the whole country, and we must march under the banner of an all-national program. The power of the revolutionary organizations must be limited. And see, the workers had no concept of limiting the fight. On the contrary, their experience of the February Revolution had led them to expect that they should be able to do away with the cruel and autocratic conditions that existed in the factories. As one of the worker delegates to the first session of the Petrograd Soviet said, will political freedom alone aid the workers to live in a human fashion? No. It is necessary to secure the minimum conditions of existence, the 8-hour day, the minimum wage, because with the old conditions still in existence, freedoms to us will be useless. And it is this sentiment that drove the workers back to the factories and to begin to organise to improve the conditions of factory life in, as we'll see, every possible way. And for the workers, the question of power is a practical question. It's a question of how to safeguard the gains of the February Revolution. And for them, the reason that they initially support the provisional government, and it's uneven, but at that time a majority of workers support the provisional government, is because two things. One is the euphoria actually lends itself to a mood of unity. So the left SR paper describes the mood like this. They say, the events of February made people forget what only a few days earlier had been their irreconcilable differences with the landowners and the capitalists. It seemed like we were all united. And those that did feel that they should be cautious felt the need to be silent. Again, a left SR delegate describes his feelings at the Petrograd Soviet meeting in March. He said, for was this the place to preach one's disbelief? Not to convince, but only to darken human joy, joy that for many was the first. I envied these people who believed so sincerely that it was all over, that the revolution was completed and that a whole new way of life would begin, but I could not help feeling that it was not so and ahead lay a difficult path. And this points to the second reason that I think workers at this time support the provisional government, and that is their fear of counter-revolution, particularly those that had lived through 1905. It's significant that at the Thornton metalworking factory, it was noted that all of the delegates to the factory committees were, after all, single. So in other words, they don't have families to think of if the repression gets too bad. And so it's this sentiment that leads the workers to think they need to maximise their forces who've supported the February Revolution in order to fend off any ensuing counter-revolution. But what you can see here is that there is a gulf of reasons between why the moderates support the provisional government and why they continue to do so right through 1917 to prop up the provisional government at any cost, and why the workers at the beginning support the provisional government, because that helps us to understand why the shift is so rapid as workers see the reality of what the provisional government stands for and in whose interests they act. So what precipitates this shift? Well, here I want to start with the factory committee movement. Now, the factory committees originally spring up, thank you, they originally spring up in the largest workplaces. In the workplaces with over 5,000 workers, 100% of them had factory committees. In the workplaces with less than 40, 5% of them had factory committees. And that's because in the larger workplaces, the workers have more industrial muscle. In the smaller places, it's easier to just sack the people who put their hands up to be delegates and to repress and intimidate that way. Now, and that's why the big factories are the ones that set the political tone. Now, in politics, this is often seen as an evil, big dominating small. However, there's a logic of the struggle. If you take a place like the Narva district, for example, smack bang in the middle, you have the Putilov Works. You have 30,000 metal workers. All around it, you have small workplaces little more than 50, 100 workers. And for them, their main clout was to be able to threaten their employers with the Putilovsky are with us. So, actually, far from this being an evil, it actually strengthened the ability of the smaller workplaces to take action. Now, in terms of some of the activities that the factory committee concerned itself with, it was the sorts of demands like being paid fortnightly, selling defective goods at cost price, overtime to be made voluntary and to be paid at time and a half, the right to hold meetings without the permission or the presence of administration. The factory committees organised canteens. At a time of acute food shortages, they tried to provide meals to as many people as possible and to stave off hunger, a task that ended up being too great. But nonetheless, the fact that they tried gave them enormous prestige amongst the workers. But one of the most important demands, I think, that's worth looking at is that of the 8-hour day, because it was one of the key demands of the 1905 revolution as well. And it provokes one of the first debates in the Soviet meeting as early as March the 5th. You see, there is a debate about whether or not to call off the general strike and to go back to the factories before the 8-hour day has been universally decreed. And although workers speak for maintaining the strike, they end up voting overwhelmingly to go back to work. However, among them, when this is taken back to the factories, it is greeted with hostility by and large. And by 2 days later, only a fifth of the workplaces that reported to the Soviets had actually gone back to work. And where they did, it was because they'd instituted the 8-hour day and they had won the demand. It's interesting to see that this demand is seen by both the bosses and the workers as both political and economic. Like a lot of the demands, it was about improving the conditions of their work, but it was also about saying that workers are the ones who should have the right to decide, just like hiring and firing, just like the right to hold meetings and some of those things. So there is not a clear separation between the political and the economic demands. But one of the other common duties of the factory committees that I wanted to raise as well was that they tried the more notorious managers and foremen. People would those foremen were charged with things like coarse behaviour. And what did this mean? It meant those that physically punished the workers for disobedience. Those that sexually harassed women workers. At the Baltic Shipbuilding factory, or works, they charged one of the foremen for acting more like a police officer and for turning the atmosphere in the workplace into a disciplinary department where, and I quote, with aching hearts, one could hear his reply, "I'll ship you to the front." And so in a lot of it, in this, you see, a lot of it is about forcing the bosses to recognise their dignity. And I think that this was awakened in their participation in the February Revolution. It's that sense of I grew up that was unfolding at a factory level. And that's why the factory committees didn't just limit their activities to the economic conditions, but tried to ameliorate all aspects of life. In one factory, the committee gave the director's house and garden to the children to make it into a kindergarten. They organised social clubs and theatrical performances and musical performances. Education was a big part of it. At the Baltic Works, they had women instruct other women workers. At the Rosencrantz factory, they had a person teach literacy by writing Bolshevik slogans on the blackboard. I suspect she was teaching them a little bit more than reading and writing. And I think the spirit that they undertook these activities is summed up by this appeal from one of the factory committees. They said, "Let the idea that knowledge is everything sink deep into our consciousness. Comrades, do not let slip the opportunity of gaining scientific knowledge. Do not waste a single hour fruitlessly, because every hour is dear to us. We need to not only catch up with the classes with whom we are fighting, but to overtake them. That is life's command. That is where the finger is pointing. We are now the masters of our own lives, and so we must become the masters of all the weapons of knowledge." I think of that next time I'm on Facebook. Guilty. So, to conclude this point, I think when you read about the factory committees and their activities, who could possibly doubt the initiative of the working class? But what I want to go on to argue is that this was driven not by some ideology, neither by Bolshevism or syndicalism, but as a practical response to the necessities that are provoked by the economic crisis. And that's why you see that they extend their activities, they start to encroach more and more on management's roles, or, you know, traditional management roles, as the economic crisis worsens. Initially, you have bosses make every effort to try to be conciliatory, to grant concessions, to give in to some of the demands. However, as the economic crisis worsens, for a lot of the capitalists, it was cheaper for them to close rather than to, let alone to grant wage rises. And so you have an outbreak of sabotage to try to effectively starve the revolutionary movement. And so workers demand things like the right to control hiring and firing, the right to inspect the books, they start to source materials in one place, the water supply runs out, and so they build a canal. And I think that this kind of practical response is summed up by one of the Bolshevik delegates to the factory committees, who said, "All the works and factories of Russia are experiencing a crisis. The management do not display any activism in supplying their factories with sufficient quantity of raw materials and fuels. As a result, the workers may be thrown to the mercy of hunger and unemployment, and therefore it is the workers themselves who must show activism in this sphere, since the employers are not showing any. Only the unified organisation of factory committees, not only in Petrograd but throughout Russia, can do this. It is obvious that there must exist workers' organisations everywhere which band together to intervene into industrial life in an organised manner." And so the pressure to band together is building because it is now much harder to win. And so spontaneous sectional strikes around more narrow economic questions give way at this time around, you know, May and June. They give way to more organised strikes that involve larger numbers. And these were particularly important in radicalising the unskilled section of the working class. And see, the economic struggles directly raise the question of political power. And I want to look at this from a few perspectives. We've already mentioned about how a lot of the demands that at first seem economic actually impinge on the political realm. They raise the question of who has the right to control working life. But secondly, the factory committees were reluctant in a lot of places to take full control of the workplace when they didn't enjoy the commensurate political control, because the problem for them was that otherwise they were doing effectively coolie duty for the bourgeoisie. And so they needed to strive for full control. It was only those factories where the employers had completely abandoned them that the workers took over. Secondly, the militia... What are we up to? Thirdly, the militia is a good illustration... The question of the militia is a good illustration of how the political and the economic come together. Thank you. Because we see that workers tried to organise their own independent armed grouping, the Red Guards, because they saw this as necessary to back up their power in the workplace. In the debate about whether they should disarm, which I might add it was the Mensheviks and the SRs that supported their incorporation into the Duma rather than maintaining their independence and being responsible to the Soviets. The Bolsheviks were the only ones that defended their independence. But in this debate, one of the delegates, you know, points to why this mattered, why they needed a militia. He said, if we have a Red Guard, then they'll take us into account. At the head of the district contingent, that's where the Red Guard should march. Then they wouldn't tear down our red flags. So it is a question of class power. Thirdly, I'm always one step behind. Fourthly, inflation was so rampant that it was rendering a lot of the wage gains, to the extent that they were won later in the year, it was rendering them worthless. The metal workers' contract that was negotiated over a three-month period was an extremely bitter dispute, and the bitterness was because the economic situation for workers trying to survive on starvation wages was absolutely acute. And so, to wait for 3 months for a pay increase was bad enough. However, as one of the Bolsheviks who worked at the Putilov concluded, our wage gain, even if we win it, will be rendered worthless by inflation. And so a decisive struggle is necessary to establish workers' control of production and distribution, which in turn requires the transfer of power into the hands of the Soviets. And finally, the disputes around the economic demands play an extremely important role in radicalising the workers, because it's their experience that reveals to them on whose side the moderates and the provisional government are on. That same Bolshevik, Gessner, describes what happened in the Putilov during the metal workers' contract dispute. He says, the Putilov Works has come over decisively to our side. The militant mood of the Putilov Works has deep economic roots. The question of wage increases is an acute one. From the beginning of the revolution, the workers' demands for wage increases were not satisfied. The Minister of Labour came to our factory and promised to satisfy the demands, but he didn't fulfil his promise. And that's why on June 18, the Putilovsky bore the placard saying, "They have deceived us. We have seen with our own eyes how the present provisional government refuses to take the resolute measures against the capitalists, without which our demands cannot be satisfied. The interests of the capitalists are dearer to it than the interests of the working class." And this was more and more the conclusion that workers were coming to. So how then do the moderates and the Bolsheviks fare in all of this? Well, contrary to Adrian Jones's supposition that the Bolsheviks that the workers could not tell the difference between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, actually, as workers came face to face with the betrayals of the provisional government, they deserted the moderates in droves. Even some of their own members of the SRs and the Mensheviks left and joined the Bolsheviks at this time. A resolution that was passed in the Anshar knitwear factory gives us a sense of why the workers had it up to here with the conciliation of the Mensheviks and the SRs. They said, "Yet all the conciliations of the Mensheviks and SRs with the bourgeoisie cannot lead the country out of its dead end, but can only bring it to further disorder. We declare that the fear of the majority of the Soviets to take power into their hands proves the bankruptcy of their policies and allows the wing of counter-revolution to mock the working class, and that's why we're for all power to the Soviets." Thank you. So, no one is thinking that the Soviets can now control the provisional government, because they have seen that the role of the Mensheviks and the SRs as they step into a coalition government with Kerensky, they succeed not in controlling the provisional government, but rather to co-opt the Soviet agenda. The Minister for Labour, for example, himself a socialist, makes this appeal to the workers in June, in the middle of a crisis of starvation. He appeals to them for sacrifice. Comrade workers, he says, remember not only your rights, but not only your desires, but also the possibility of their realization. Not only your welfare, but also sacrifices in the name of consolidating the revolution and the victory of our ultimate ideals. So put off these demands for better wages and conditions and make more sacrifices, he says to the starving working class. And that prompts the workers at the Zvernon factory to write him a letter. They say, having read the appeal of the Minister of Labour to the workers, we consider it necessary to report on our factory. Half of us were dismissed, and the other half have now been put on a 3.5-day week. To this, this is because the bosses cited a lack of orders and raw materials. Well, when workers checked it out, they found that all but one of the engine rooms was working at full steam. From this, it is obvious that it is not the workers who undermine the industry, but the bosses. And therefore, we ask our respected comrade minister to take decisive measures against this phenomena and to make the necessary arrests. So you can see the contempt that, that is building. And so I'd argue that the Bolsheviks win influence because they had a clear and consistent position of being for Soviet power, and it was a position that reflects the aspirations of the working class. But also because the Bolsheviks were the consistent defenders of workers' initiatives and their own organisations. It was true of the militias and it was true of the factory committees themselves, which the moderates had dismissed as merely a product of Bolshevik demagogy. It was a position that was so useless that it was mostly ignored by the rank-and-file SRs and Mensheviks, and they participated anyway. And far from the view that the Bolsheviks cynically manipulated the factory committees, actually, one of the best ways, I think, of refuting that is the fact that after the October Revolution, when the factory committees convene and draft a resolution on the role of the factory committees in the new socialist order, Lenin's comments on the draft are to insert a greater role for the grassroots factory committees. He says there's not enough of a description of the role that the individual workplaces should be playing. And so that was his position on the factory committees. Okay. The missing ingredient in this, though, is the question of the war. And we cannot underestimate the significance of the war. Contrary to, again, Adrian Jones's supposition that the provisional government were genuinely trying to bring about peace, when the secret treaties are published and the Minister of War is exposed to sending a note to Churchill that promises that the February Revolution has only increased the workers' desire to bring the war to a victorious conclusion, this provokes not understanding, but meetings and debates and even clashes on the streets between pro-war middle-class people and workers' demonstrations. Robertshire Gazetta, which is an SR paper, describes it like this. They say, everywhere at street meetings, in trams, there were passionate and heated disputes over the war taking place. The caps and the handkerchiefs stand for peace, and the derbies and bonnets for war. So it's the war that brings to the fore the class divisions and punctures that false unity that's created in February. Thank you. What's more, the war is also one of the first causes for a sharp divergence between the executive committee of the Soviets and the district-level Soviets. And that's over the Liberty Loan. The Liberty Loan is where the provisional government seeks to to raise money by cutting into working class living standards in order to pay for the war. It's a familiar story to people here. And rather disgracefully, the executive committee of the Soviets endorsed it by 21 votes to 14, the 14 in opposition being the Bolsheviks. The plenum then decides to hold off until the provisional government in practice shows that they're doing something to end the war, but they give in as well after a few weeks. But when this is taken back to the factory committees, people react with hostility. At the Roscoe Boltiski wagon construction factory, they resolved. We recognise that the Liberty Loan has as its aim the continuation of this fratricidal war, which is of benefit only to the imperialist bourgeoisie. We do not consider it possible for the socialist proletariat to take part in this loan. The money should be taken from the pockets of the bourgeoisie that has instigated and continued this slaughter, making millions in profits from this bloody frenzy. We energetically protest against the conduct of the 21 members of the executive committee who accepted the loan, and we consider such an attitude to the cause of the proletariat a betrayal of the international. Actually, it was one of the first instances occasions for recalling a number of the delegates that had supported the Liberty Loan. When the June offensive at the front is announced, again, the moderates support it. And this provokes opposition at a factory level. At the New Leicester Machine Construction Factory, they say, we declare that a blow has been dealt through the Russian Revolution and the international by this offensive, and the whole responsibility of this policy lies with the provisional government and the party of the Mensheviks and the SRs for supporting it. So you can see people are fed up with the role that the moderates have played. But I think the most damning betrayal is their support for the death penalty being reintroduced. To give you a sense of the absolute betrayal of this, and at this time when it's reintroduced, the Soviet members of the coalition government actually have a majority of 6-5 in Kerensky's coalition. They could have stopped it, and yet it is reintroduced. The workers in one of the factory describe the betrayal like this. They say, one of the dearest victories of the great Russian Revolution, the abolition of capital punishment, has been eliminated by a stroke of the provisional government's pen. In the name of saving the revolution, military courts, knowing only one sentence, execution, will be convened. And the soldiers designated for the role of executioners will hurriedly drag their worried and sick, condemned comrades, demented by 3 years of slaughter, into an isolated corner and shoot them like dogs for no other reason than because they were unwilling to sacrifice their lives for their class enemies. They eliminated the death penalty for high-ranking criminals of the Tsarist regime, but they've retained it for the soldiers who are oppressed by 3 years of senseless carnage. It is a crime to kill demented and desperate people, crazed by the recognition of the futility of their suffering and unable to see an end to this endless war. And I think it remains one of the best anti-war statements that has been written. Okay. And so it is this, is the war, the economic situation, that by May lead the Bolsheviks to be able to pass resolutions in the factory committee meeting of Petrograd by 63% for all power to the Soviets. So it's actually very early that they achieve a majority, and it is, and by October, support for an uprising is virtually unanimous. There is a strike wave that breaks out. Strikes increase from, I think, 36,000 in April to 1.2 million in October. And this, you know, has an enormous impact on the unskilled and more rural areas outside of Petrograd. And as well, are you going to give me another thank you? And as well, the Kornilov coup is the turning point. It has an impact on the working class, but it is the turning point for the soldiers in particular. Certainly something that can be discussed more in the discussion, the role that the Kornilov coup plays and the way that it is repelled by an enormous mobilisation of the workers. But what I want to just say briefly about it is that why it was so damning for the soldiers at the front and in the garrisons was because Kerensky had conspired with Kornilov. And the soldiers knew that it was to attack workers' democracy and the soldiers' democracy as it existed in the garrisons, that they had negotiated the reintroduction of the death penalty. And the fact that Kerensky had been complicit in all of this was, at the end of the day, the final nail in the coffin. And the reason that the garrisons go over now en masse to the Bolsheviks, that the Bolsheviks achieve now for the first time a majority in both the Petrograd Soviet and the Moscow Soviet and the National Soviet, that there is a mushrooming again of workers' committees in the workplaces across a wider layer, area of Russia, and the time for insurrection is ripe. But the situation is very complex in Petrograd. The mood is one of lethargy and weariness. Lethargy because only 10% of the working class had taken part in the strikes. I talked about before a strike wave is gripping Russia, well, not in Petrograd. And the reason is not because the workers have become less militant, but actually because they think the only way to resolve their problems is by the workers taking state power. And weariness because it was in Petrograd that workers had tasted defeat in July. And it's significant that it's in places like Moscow and even the places within Petrograd that didn't take part in the July rising that the mood is most favourable for insurrection. And it's a disorienting situation for the Bolsheviks to face. And the party is riven with debate at this time as to what nature the insurrection should take. Lenin makes his appeal for immediate armed insurrection that is suppressed by the Central Committee. He makes this appeal to the Petrograd Committee, to the Moscow Committee, to the lower party organs that are more in touch with the workers to start making preparations for the immediate rising. Because without decisive action, the danger was that the working class could slip back into apathy and to demoralisation. The mood was summed up really well, I think, by Sukarnov, one of the Menshevik historians of the revolution. He was speaking at the People's House on October 22nd, and he was conferring with Martov about the mood of the meeting. He'd just seen one of the SR speakers basically be eaten alive, and he was next to take the rostrum. He describes the mood like this. The mood was conditional and ambivalent. The majority were ready in their hesitation to abstain, but the minority were capable of putting together an impressive fighting force that was undoubtedly eager for the battle. The mood could not be better, but it could decline. The political conclusions had long been known, and at the first success, the flabby mood would become firm. If it doesn't end in senseless bloodshed, all will support. And so what is required at this point, as Petrograd is really on a precipice, when the mood is one of expectancy, what is required is initiative. And so, to conclude, my emphasis has been on how the material conditions, how the war and the economic crisis have been key to the radicalisation that transpired between February and October. But the Bolsheviks were able to pose a coherent alternative as people left the moderates in droves and stopped supporting the provisional government. But now was the key moment that their organisation would be tested, because what was required was decisive action. And the fact that the Bolshevik Party, for all of the debates that happened right up to the night before the revolution, the fact that they did not recoil from the task at hand is to their everlasting credit that they said, now is the time for the workers to rise. And when they did, on October 24, they were supported pretty much unanimously. That in the weeks that followed the Soviets taking power, all but one factory in Petrograd passed resolutions in support of the Soviet uprising. And so These are the people who were the real participants and the real people that made the Russian Revolution. And so I just end with a story that apparently transpired in Gorky's apartment before the revolution. There was a couple of Menshevik comrades he had around to tea, and they looked out the window and they saw the Bolsheviks, they saw some workers rather, eating fish and throwing their fish bones aside. And they looked upon this and they said, these are the people that the Bolsheviks expect to make a workers' revolution, as if like dainty eating has something to do with revolutionary potential. But what it was dismissing these workers, just as the historians of the Russian Revolution dismissed the participation of the workers in Russia. And so that's why it's our job to uncover their voices, to uncover their participation, because we believe they'll do it again and again and again.